Fine. My name is Kevin Featherstone. I'm the director of the European Institute here at the London School of Economics. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this lecture this evening. This evening's lecture is another lecture in our series this year on Europe. And the series is supported by the school's annual fund. And we're very grateful for that. We feel the series of lectures this academic year have been very successful, covering a range of topics, and I'm very much looking forward to tonight's lecture. By way of introduction, let me just make one or two points. 50 years ago, the European integration process was in crisis. The French had rejected the latest treaty on the basis of a popular backlash. The way ahead seemed very uncertain. Some believed that European unity had reached its limits. Some believed that it might even go into retreat. There's a certain parallel, qualified nevertheless, with today's sense of disorientation in the aftermath of the French and Dutch referenda results on the European Constitution. In any event, the model of European integration pursued at that stage 50 years ago owed much to the vision and strategy of Jean Monnet. He was undoubtedly the biggest single influence over the shape that integration took. Jean Monnet believed in winning over key political and economic leaders to his European cause. He believed in leaders leading the process. He showed a basic faith that the experience of integration would result in the European publics following their leaders. The reality of integration, that is, would bridge the gap between leaders and publics as the European agenda moved forward. Monnet believed in practical steps to an agreed goal. An agreed goal, a strategy overseen by a depoliticized management. By way of introduction, we have the benefits of a short video clip from a TV interview which Jean Monnet gave just before Britain joined the European Community as it then was. In this video clip, Monnet is talking about his approach, his strategy. He's emphasizing how he took forward his plan for a European coal and steel community in 1950, the approach that he made to Chancellor Adenauer in Germany, and the initial response he had here in London. So by way of introduction, there's a 2-3 minute video clip which we can hopefully show now.
Authority, I don't choose him either, he is there. So all I do is to go to see the man in authority at the when circumstances force an action and explain that I think this problem which he sees and does know how to solve can be solved on condition to accept the change and extend the frontier and solve problem not on a national basis, but on a European basis. The problem is the consequence of all sorts of circumstances. And if you change those circumstances, you change the problem. So it's one of the major error, but necessary consequence of the existence of our society as it is, that those in power attack the problem which is the difficulty. They shouldn't. They should attack. And they do, fortunately, today in this common market, begin to at least attack the context in which the difficulty presents itself. And that's what I do.
Why then at that particular point, coal and steel, France and Germany?
There was still in many people's mind the notion that the peace with Germany should be based on notion of superiority, domination, which was the peace of 1918. And I felt that that was, would be a catastrophe. It was necessary to change the psychology of Europe, which still was a psychology of war.
John McCloy was now military governor of Germany, a country under military occupation. On the Control Commission, the Americans were more eager to change the psychology of war than the Europeans. Understandably, the French particularly continued to fear and suspect Germany.
Up to that point, we had the feeling that the French were quite negative in their attitude in regard to the new Germany. It did seem that they were putting roadblocks in the way of most of what we thought was constructive steps that should be taken in order to restore or create a good world order after the war. And we talked about this rather frankly with the French from time to time. And Monet was around at that time. He appeared on the Rhine. This was another center of decision, and naturally Monet was to be there. Monet, I always had the feeling, was the one who really sold this concept of equality to the French. It had to be sold to the French, and it had to be sold to the Germans.
I went to see Adenauer in the spring of 1915, May 1915. I found a man who, I think, found it hard to believe that we were really proposing equality. There was a certain suspicion in the beginning of the talk on that very point. But then as I developed the discussion, it became quite clear and evident to Mr. Adenauer that the French government was bent on establishing equality. You must realize what it was, equality. Equality between Europe, the French and the British and the Germans. It's equality between the victors and the vanquished. To establish that equality was quite something you never had been done before. In the past, the victors imposed their will and the vanquished had to do what the victors said. This was not the case. We said equality from the start.
What was Adenauer's reaction when he understood that that astonishing thing was really being offered to him?
I think he was moved.
Persuading the Germans was one thing, persuading the British quite another. In 1950, Monet came to London, his aim to get the British government to join the coal and steel community. His talks were with Sir Stafford Cripps.
We had long discussions for days and didn't finish because Mr. Stafford Cripps said, I accept to participate in the negotiations, but I will not accept the objective. But I said, how can you negotiate on those conditions?
Monet wanted to.
Hush. Thank you. A short clip to indicate something of the vision at the time. Clearly, the strategy was new. Some people thought it was too technocratic. Others thought it was too elitist. The Italian Federalist, Spinelli, later concluded that Jean Monnet should take the credit for having built Europe, but also the blame for having built it badly. I'm paraphrasing. In any event, Monet's legacy for today's European Union has been enormous. The institutional design of the Commission, the technocratic style, the process of uniting Europe sector by sector, market integration, leading more recently to the single European market. These are fundamental parts of the Monet legacy. Next year sees the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome. Again, a treaty consistent with Monet's approach. It's an appropriate time for us to ask the question, how well has the approach stood the test of time? Is the vision still relevant to a European Union today of 25 member states, 25 plus member states. The vast majority of today's member states had no meaningful contacts with Monet or his ideas, and of course the European Union has expanded well beyond the world Monet knew. Is European integration today so deep, so wide, that Monet's approach has passed its sell-by dates, as it were? The institutional structure that Monet influenced so much is so very different from anything we're used to at the national level. Today, with deeper, wider integration, is that contrast an advantage, a disadvantage? We're privileged to have a speaker such as Richard Main to address some of these matters for us this evening. Richard Main was part of Jean Monnet's staff in the 1950s. Later, he would translate Monnet's memoirs into English. Dr. Main also worked for the first president of the European Commission, Walter Hallstein. Later, he was the head of the Commission's London office when Britain joined the European Community. Alongside this career and this work, he's published a number of books and articles on the history and institutions of the European Union. He's translated a number of books from French into English. Along the way, he also managed to compile a nautical dictionary, The Language of Sailing, to suggest something of the breadth. He's worked as a journalist for a number of newspapers and magazines. He was a film critic for the Sunday Telegraph. He's held a number of academic posts. All of this, I think, testifies to quite an extraordinary career. International public servant, journalist, author, translator, film critic, the list could go on. Few people have known Europe as well as Richard Main. He speaks from vast experience and a breadth of vision. I'm very much looking forward to hearing his reflections on where we are today. Please give a warm welcome to Richard Main.
I'm slightly reminded of Ken Loach's experience when he went to Cannes to get a Lifetime Achievement Award, and he said, "Does that mean my life is over?" But it was very moving to see Monet again, to hear his voice again. He was, of course, quite old then. When I first met him, he was a good deal younger and spryer and quicker. And he was also very terre-à-terre, very down-to-earth. I remember the first time I walked into his office, and he was on the telephone. And he said, "Don't forget the chicken for 8 o'clock." And he put the phone down, picked up the other phone, and said, "Get me Adenauer." Now, that was typical of this man, that he had, on the one hand, this very, very personal concern about food and living and his family and so on, and at the same time, he was talking on a level of equality with some of the most powerful people in Europe. So he was an extraordinary man in that respect. On one occasion, when he was much younger, he had to go to a place in France to meet the local préfet. But the préfet couldn't meet him. And so the préfet sent his deputy to meet this great man off the train. And the deputy had never seen Monet. And he asked his boss, "How do I recognize him?" "Oh, he looks like everybody," said the man. And of course, and he met him and he recognized him very easily. I always thought he looked like a French peasant. And so did Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek said, "You're a real peasant. You're also a Chinaman." And this sort of humble appearance, this modest appearance, this simple way of talking was very, very important. He wasn't an elitist at all. Monet would have not understood what the word meant. He never went to a university. He left school at the age of 16, and he went to work in a wine merchant in London to learn English. So he never had the disadvantage of a French education, a French higher education. What he did have, of course, was incredible intelligence, very, very sharp intelligence. And he used to think about whatever he was thinking about by going for a walk.
It was very disconcerting to go for a walk with Monet, because every now and then he would suddenly stop and not say a word. And then he would say, "I'm a miller in Hamburg." "I'm a miller in Hamburg?" He was talking about the common agricultural policy, and he was trying to work out what happened if you were a miller. And I found it very difficult to have conversation with him on a walk. For the rest of the time, it was much easier when he was in the office, although he always used to accuse me and one or two French colleagues of being too intellectual. He said of one colleague, Pierre Uri, who is a very brilliant economist, he said, "You know, Uri is too complicated. If you ask him how many people are sitting around the table, he'll dive under the table, count the legs, and divide by two." And Monet's approach was always much simpler than that. He would talk to anybody. He would ask anybody's opinion. He didn't talk only to Enarch or to high civil servants. He talked to taxi drivers. He talked to his own staff. He talked to anybody he could meet. And he would be interested in their opinion, so that there was never any instance in Monet's life of being elitist, of trying to only impose integration of Europe from above. That, I think, is the first point that's worth making, that he was a man of the people, and he was a very modest man, although he didn't have the false modesty of some of the other people that you know in the European scene. When he wrote his memoirs, they were ghosted. They were written by a very good novelist called François Fontaine, who'd worked for Monet for a long time, and had written quite a lot of very good novels, historical novels, and who wrote wonderfully smooth and beautiful French. When I read them, I thought, this doesn't sound like Monet at all. And Monet's wife, Sylvia, said to me, "You know, no, she spoke English, or French rather, with an Italian accent. I won't try and imitate it. But she said, this doesn't sound like Monet." And when I showed her my translation of Monet, which I'd deliberately return to something more like Monet's simple way of writing, she said, "Yes, that's much more like Jean, much more like Jean," because he was a simple man in some respects, and he didn't have any concern for literary accomplishment or beauty or stylishness, and he hated what he called images. He hated people who used metaphors and analogies. He liked to speak very, very plainly and clearly. The result, when we reached a result together, was as plain and clear as water. But it was as powerful as gin. The fact was that on one occasion, after the assassination of Kennedy, Monet's Action Committee, which grouped all the political parties and trade unions of the original European Community countries, his Action Committee had to produce a resolution about new policies after the death of Kennedy and the death of what seemed to be the road we were on. And we wrote this. It took us 140 different versions to get to the final version. And the final version was as clear as anything, absolutely dead simple, but very, very good. And we'd been through so many complications. It wasn't very different from the first version, but in key points it was. And it was that assiduity, that constant working at a subject that made Monet as powerful a thinker and as powerful a persuader as he was. He had the good fortune to know a whole lot of people who were important later. But he himself, as I say, wasn't imposing his ideas from above. He was always trying to draw other people's opinion into his conception and into the policies that he would propose. In my view, he was the one of two great Frenchmen of this last century, and the other one, of course, was de Gaulle. Monet and de Gaulle, it's a subject you could write a book about, or several books, and they worked together for a while when de Gaulle came to London in 1940, and the night when he arrived in Monet's flat, Monet was already working then on Franco-British supplies. He'd been a Franco-British civil servant in World War I, and he took up the same role in World War II. And he came in late from the office. De Gaulle had arrived early with his aide-de-camp, And Madame Monet was waiting to receive him. And the girl came in, and as usual, this tall figure stood in front of the fireplace. And Madame Monet was sitting on one side, and the aide-de-camp was sitting on the other. And Madame Monet asked the girl, are you here en mission, Monsieur le Général? And the girl said, je ne suis pas ici en mission, madame. Je suis ici pour sauver l'honneur de la France. Which was pretty good. I mean, it seemed a rather pompous thing to say. But Madame Monet then said, well, how are you going to do it? And the girl pulled out from his pocket the speech he was going to make on the radio on the 18th of June. And he handed it not to Madame Monet, but to the aide-de-camp, who had to walk round the girl to hand it to Madame Monet. A typical gesture of a very proud and in many ways rather shy man. They got on quite well at the beginning. It was Monet who proposed the idea of Franco-British Union, which was accepted not only by de Gaulle, but also by Churchill, two romantic nationalists who accepted the idea of union in the middle of a war. They tried to get the French government to accept it, and Renault had fallen, and the French government was in a mess, and Pétain was on the way, so it was too late. But Monet, again, being persistent, went off to France with some friends to see if he couldn't rescue some of the members of the French cabinet and bring them back to Britain to continue fighting the war. Well, he didn't succeed in that. But after he came back, there were two possibilities. One was to fight from London, and the other, Monet thought, was to fight from North Africa. He tried to persuade de Gaulle to go to North Africa. De Gaulle didn't want to do that. He wanted to be where the action was, which is in London. And Monet was then recruited by the British to work in Washington on the British Supply Council. And they parted. They disagreed. They parted. But later on, when de Gaulle was established in Algiers as the head of the provisional government, he had Monet working with him on supplies. So Monet and de Gaulle were, during the war, quite often working together. But they disagreed fundamentally about the kind of Europe that was going to be built. And de Gaulle essentially believed in an intergovernmental Europe. Monet believed in an integrated Europe. Monet believed that cooperation on a simply intergovernmental basis for particular projects was not going to work, and that what had to be done was to try to unite people in a much more organic fashion. And his idea of Europe was very different from de Gaulle's idea, which was a Europe of nation states, largely dominated by France. And I remember once when I went into Monet's house, actually, it was at home, he'd been listening to de Gaulle speaking about this on the radio, and he said, il est fou, he's crazy. And he then explained that he thought that if de Gaulle wanted, as he did, to stand up to the Americans, it was no good standing up as a Frenchman. France alone was not going to be equal to America. Only Europe could be equal to America, if that. And if you didn't make Europe in the way that Monet thought possible, and de Gaulle was not going to do that, you couldn't possibly stand up to the Americans. So that seemed to Monet to be a foolish way of trying to achieve ends, which de Gaulle couldn't do. On the other hand, there was great respect between them. On another occasion, when de Gaulle had died, curious enough, he died on Monet's birthday, on the 9th of November. And I had the ill fortune or the bad taste to say to Monet, what a birthday present. And Monet was furious. No, don't talk like that. And I quite understood then that he felt a kind of respect and affection for the man who was politically at the opposite end of the spectrum. In fact, when right at the end of the life of both of them, there was a reception in Paris for the Grand Duchess of Luxembourg. And Luxembourg was where the coal and steel community had been founded and where Monet had lived for 5 years. And he was invited to the reception at the Élysée by de Gaulle to meet or to re-meet the Grand Duchess, who was rather like Margaret Dumont in the Marx Brothers films, actually. At the reception, de Gaulle said, "Can we not speak apart to Monet?" And Monet said, "All right." They went and talked together. And de Gaulle said, "I'd like to talk with you tomorrow." And Monet went along to the following day to meet de Gaulle. And in the conversation, de Gaulle said, "Would you like a more active life? Meaning, would you work with me?" And Monet thought for a while, and you see how he hesitates when he thinks. He's silent for a moment. And he said, "You know, I have only one idea." Ah, yes, I know," said de Gaulle. Monet told me that story. It's never been published. But it showed that he and de Gaulle were capable of respecting and liking each other, even though they disagreed very fundamentally. I was interviewing him for a BBC radio program. I asked Monet, "Do you think de Gaulle has helped or hindered matters?" And we had a pause on the tape, which was so long that it would have made people think that the BBC had broken down. We had to cut it down to a reasonable time. Monet said nothing. "Do you think he's helped or hindered matters?" "I think both. Some people may say that he's helped because he was a great speaker. Some people may say he's delayed matters. But Europe is not to be delayed. Europe has to continue." That was Monet's view. Europe has to continue. And whenever any great setback occurred, and one big setback was when de Gaulle vetoed the British, I said to Monet, "You know, it's depressing. C'est déprimant." "Non, c'est attristant. It's saddening." He would never be completely negative. He said in a very disappointed voice once, "I'm never disappointed." Well, he was sometimes disappointed. And the question now is, would he be disappointed with the Europe we have? My view is that he would say, "We've got it, and we have to do what we can. We've got 25 members. It makes a very unwieldy European Union. It has enormous number of languages. It has enormous number of policies. It has enormous number of difficulties and enormous number of people." Once, Monet said to me, "If once we're more than 250 people, we'll be lost." Well, 250 people is a very modest estimate now, except for escaped prisoners. And the community is a hugely different thing from the one that Monet proposed and got accepted by the governments. But there are two features of the community that Monet held to, and I think he would still hold to. One is that there has to be somebody whose job it is not to look at the national interest, not even to look at the sum of the national interests, but to look at the interests of everybody. And that is the job of the Commission, independent of all the member states, forbidden to take instructions from anybody, and responsible only to the European Parliament and controlled only by the Court of Justice. That is a very key point in the existence of the community, and it's even more important now that we have 25 members instead of 6. So that is the first thing that was very important in Monet's original thinking. He didn't want to have recrudescence of something like the Council of Europe, where everybody argued and nobody did anything. He wanted a body that would look at the common interest and propose things that could be accepted by everybody after a lot of trouble and difficulty, and usually with mistakes and compromises. But nevertheless, for example, some of the European ecological decisions would never have been taken if it weren't for the Commission. things have been done, cleaning up rivers and so on, which would never have happened if there hadn't been a commission to oversee the whole picture. So that was one very important side of Monet's approach to Europe, which I think is still very valid, even though we have to streamline the institutions. And the other thing that's very important about Monet, or in Monet's thinking, was that you change what you can when you can and hope that it will change the context in which people operate. I have the chance now to look back over many, many years of the European Union, and in some ways it's a horrifying thought that we've come all this way and done all these things. Monet once said, I was talking with him again, when we walked down into the Belimont building in Brussels, and it was just after lunch. We were having a very late lunch with the president of Luxembourg, and all the functionaries were dashing back to their offices after having their copious lunches in various bistros, and the functionaries were going back very fast, and it was scurrying along. And I said to Monet, isn't it amazing to think that all this building, all these people, and all their activities were once just a simple piece of paper on your desk? He looked around and said, yes, it's horrible. And that is very characteristic. He was very nervous of creating a great bureaucracy. He was very uncertain about making the community too large. And I think he would now say that we have got to work very hard with 25 countries to achieve some of the things that Europe had to achieve, has to achieve still, and it was much easier when there were only six. I think, personally, Monet might have liked to have only the British and the Irish in, as well as the six, but he knew perfectly well that you couldn't stop anybody coming in, provided they agreed to the conditions and the necessary disciplines of the community. So what would Monet say now about Turkey, about the need for a constitution? What would he say about the French and Dutch referenda, which rejected the constitutional treaty? My view is that Monet would not be talking about any of these things directly. He would not be talking about Europe. He wasn't talking about Europe when he founded the whole thing. He was talking about the world situation. He was talking about the Cold War. The purpose of building Europe was partly to integrate Germany into a structure in which Germany could contribute to other European countries without dominating them. Equality, as we heard. He was also concerned, really, with making sure that the Cold War didn't become a hot war. And now I think he would be very concerned with, for example, Al-Qaeda, for example, Iraq, for example, the likelihood of irresponsible action by one or other of the superpowers. He'd be very concerned at the moment about energy supplies. And he would be concentrating on these practical, serious, important matters. And he wouldn't be talking about the need to have different majority voting system in the Council of Ministers. He wouldn't be talking about giving more power to the European Parliament, though he might think it was a good idea. He would be talking about the really big issues that concern everybody. He'd be talking about defense, he'd be talking about employment, he'd be talking about modernization, globalization, all these big world issues have always been Monet's preoccupation. And Europe, in his view, was a way of approaching a solution to them. The first book I ever wrote about the European community was called The Community of Europe. It was written in a series with people like Anthony Sampson and so on. But at the end of it, I said, and Monet read the book. It was one of the few books he read, apart from Peter Cheney. He read that book, and he applauded the end, in which I said, today the name of the endeavor is Europe. Tomorrow it should be the world. And he always considered world issues far more important than technical, parochial European issues. So that when the purpose of Europe for Monet was to help solve problems and to prevent European inter-European rivalry and and dissension and conflict. In his view, I think, there are four main issues within Europe. The first one was to prevent war between the member states. Well, there's no chance of that happening again now, it seems. We seem to be beyond war. Trade war, he was against that too. That we're not completely beyond. There's a lot of rivalry, and there's a certain amount of economic nationalism creeping into policies, national policies, in Western Europe particularly. And it may happen that there'll be some sort of rivalry between the low-wage countries in the East and in Eastern Europe and the higher-wage countries in the West of Europe, quite apart from the menace of globalization, which the French are so worried about. Monet would want very much to prevent that sort of economic warfare escalating within the community. The third purpose, in Monet's view, I think, would be to establish as the beginning of civilization, the germ, as he called it, of civilization, rules and institutions which bind nations. And in that respect, he would be, in a sense, a federalist, though he never used the word federal. Spinelli, whom we heard about, did use the word federal quite a lot. Monet was never a federalist. He wouldn't have understood what the word meant. He was not a great logic chopper or intellectual in that sense. He'd said, no, it's a practical problem. Let's solve the practical problem. That would be Monet's approach. But he would certainly believe, and he certainly said it, that he wanted to see people, countries, behaving towards each other under rules and institutions as individuals behave towards each other in a nation state. The final thing, and this is really the beginning as well as the end, that Monet wanted and still would want, is for Europe as a whole to play its part in the world as an equal to the superpowers. I keep saying superpowers. There's only one really now. But still, one can't discount the former Soviet Union. But certainly Monet always wanted an equal partnership between America and Europe. Not because he wanted Europe to kowtow to America, not because he wanted Europe to criticize America, to attack America, to be anti-American, but because he wanted the two great powers to be equal and be able to speak to each other as equals and, if necessary, to be frank with each other. This was always the difference between him and de Gaulle. De Gaulle would be rude to America from a position of weakness. Monet wanted to be polite to America, but firm with America from a position of strength. And my own view is that he would be very, very skeptical about the possibility of war in Iran, that he would be very critical of the decision to invade Iraq, that he would be very worried about the present energy situation, the oil situation, and the gas situation, and that he would be urging the Europeans to get together in fields in which they are not yet equipped with the institutions to act singly. The problem with the European Union from a purely parochial, internal, institutional point of view is that we have the institutions to deal with the economy. We don't have the institutions to deal fully with the great political issues, with defense and with security. And I think that probably Monet would now be proposing that we might revert to the idea of the European defense community, which he put forward in 1950 under the name of the Pleven Plan, because René Pleven was the Prime Minister of France who proposed it, although Monet had devised it. And it failed in 1954. Monet would be very anxious, I think, to enlarge the competence of the European Union to take in the areas where European Union is not complete enough for Europe to act as a solid body. But on specific things, I think he would probably say, well, we must have the Turks in. It'll be difficult. It'll be unpopular in France, as it was shown in the referendum. We must accept the challenge of globalization, although that too would be unpopular in France. And we must try to improve the institutional structure, make it more democratic, give the European Parliament more power. One of the things that he used to propose was that the European Parliament should elect the President of the Commission. Well, that's one way of helping things, but Monnet was always trying to solve the next immediate political problem in a way that didn't prejudice the future. If anyone asked me what his view of the future Europe would be, I have to answer that he didn't know. He didn't know. All he knew was that you had to go forward and that you had to solve problems immediately without prejudicing what you did later. He didn't have the idea of a United States of Europe, although his committee was called that. He didn't even know what it meant. It was a great slogan. But a United States of Europe couldn't be like the Americans, couldn't be like the Swiss. It would be something completely different from anything that had been shown before on the face of this earth. Because the states of America all speak the same language, for example. They all have very, well, more or less the same language. They have a lot in common. Whereas the states of Europe, 25 of them, speak so many languages that, you know, if they all spoke at once, it would be a Babel. And they have many different problems, many different historical attitudes and problems that we can't always understand because we're not a nation, we're not nationals of those particular countries. I don't know what the Slovenians have at their heart of hearts, for example. But Monnet would say, we don't know what Europe is going to be like, but we do know that we're going there together. And in that sense, he's rather like the old army marching song. We don't know where we're going until we're there. And he would also say, I think, that this generation, cannot prejudice the decisions taken by our children. What we can do is give them the chance to choose, which they wouldn't have had if Europe hadn't started. Thanks very much.
Yes, of course.
Thank you, Richard, for that very entertaining, clear, stimulating talk. We have some time for questions, so I can now invite you to make your contributions. As you do, could you please simply identify yourself? There are microphones available for you to use as well. Could we take the gentleman here?
My name is Mr. Bonfo. I am a consultant on regional development. I would like to ask a question. What was the view concerning the decentralization process? How does he view the decentralization now with so much pushing in Europe or give more power to the region with the view of the...
So I didn't quite catch it. More power to... How would Monnet have viewed the...
The regionalization, in Europe.
Of Europe.
Well, I think an orthodox federalist would have said it would be excellent to have more power to regions, but only if regions want it. Monnet's attitude towards regionalism was very, very rudimentary. He didn't talk about it. But what I think he really believed was that, as he said in a soundbite, we are not trying to make coalitions of states, we are trying to unite people. And if the regions are a better way of doing it than simply organizing interstate relations, then let's do that. But what he was really concerned with was making sure that the nation states didn't obstruct the process of further unity among the peoples that they represented. Now, some nation states have been very obstructive. De Gaulle was very obstructive at one time. The British have been obstructive in a rather subtler way, without saying so. And the same is true, I think, of some of the other countries. In fact, yesterday I was hearing an MEP telling me that there was Euroscepticism everywhere. And I think that the Monnet's concern was not to weaken the member states, but to make sure that they work together. And if having regional integration as well as national integration would help that process, he would be in favor of it. But he didn't talk about it much.
Thank you. Please, gentleman here.
Thank you very much. My name is Alexis Lautenberg. I'm the Swiss ambassador here to the UK. Professor, it is not without a great emotion that I listen to you. I belong to the generation that was raised by Henri Riben, who passed away just 2 months ago and who has been for almost 40 years the president of the Jean Monnet Foundation in Lausanne. And he really vaccinated a generation of us about Jean Monnet and the whole thinking of the founding fathers. I'd just like to make one remark and put two questions. I mean, the remark is that I've spent the 90s as ambassador to the EU in a particularly difficult moment for Switzerland. There is, of course, one element that struck me that has certainly remained, at least towards till the end of the 90s. I'm not 100% sure whether it's entirely true these days, which is the méthode Monnet, which the method of Monnet, which has remained an element of continuity, as I said, certainly till the end of the 90s, and was a very striking element of those years. Now, the two questions. The first one is, what would Monnet have thought of the 10 years of Jacques Delors, which have really changed the institution to its very, very roots? And the second one, do you think he ever believed that Central and Eastern European countries would have become members one day? I'd just like to add, for those who don't know the Monnet Foundation, that shortly before he passed away, Professor Riben identified his successor, and as you probably know, his successor is Professor Guérimet.
Well, I'd like to associate myself with what you said about Henri Riben, because Riben, whom I've known now, well, I knew before he died for many, many years. I think I first met him in 1956, and he was a great stalwart, and he has done a tremendous amount in preserving Monet's archives in Switzerland, where people can study the work of Monet, and even some of the papers that would otherwise have been destroyed during the war, because his family burnt quite a lot of his papers. So let's you know, think of Riben as one of Monet's great disciples and great friend. Monet always had a slightly amused attitude towards Riben, because he thought he was a bit of a theorifer, which he was. And Monet was, although he was, you know, he liked to have his own little gang around him. There were four of us, roughly. Nevertheless, he would be amused at our expense. On the question of the enlargement to the east of Europe, I don't think Monet ever considered it would happen. Because at the time when Monet died, in 1979, the Berlin Wall had not come down. And the world was still the very bipolar world that we'd had since the end of World War II. So while Monet was always in principle saying that any country that was democratic, that had free trade unions and free press, free speech and so on, and was European, could not be prevented from joining the community, I don't think he ever really envisaged that these countries would knock on the door. However, if he had lived on to see the knock on the door, and by the way, the wall came down on Monet's birthday. That's another birthday present. But if he had lived to see the spread of democracy into the Eastern Europe, I'm sure that he would have said, we must have them in, and we must strengthen the institutional system so that they don't find themselves adrift. We can't let Europe slide back into the Europe of the Council of Europe, where there's no central authority, there's no democratic structure. We have to have more than just nation states getting together. But if they are willing to accept all that, they must come in. The example, I think, which is relevant to this is Britain itself. Because in 1950, when he was proposing the European Coal and Steel Community, the French government delegated Monet to conduct negotiations with the British. And the stumbling point was whether or not the British would accept some sort of supranationality, whether they would accept a power above the nation state. And the British were very, very reluctant to do that. And the French, through Monet, the papers are very, very interesting to read. You see Monet trying to explain again and again and again that this is nothing terrible, that this is the manner of civilization. It's the germ of civilization. And there's another BBC recording, which I didn't quote today, in which he made a speech at the Man-Made Fibers Conference in 1961, in which it was actually written by a friend of mine, a very close friend, François Duchesne, who's now dead, who worked with Monet. And the phrase that I wanted to quote was, some people think we are trying to build a 19th century nation state from Europe, but we are not in the 19th century. That's what Monet said, and he didn't believe in living in the past or trying to create something like a nation state in Europe, but he did believe in letting people who were willing to start on the adventure come in. He wanted the British to come in if they would accept the terms of the adventure. And I'm sure that when the Poles and the rest of them knock on the door, whether they're Polish plumbers or not, he would say, let them in provided they are willing to sign up to the treaty and what it implies. I've forgotten your second question, I'm sorry. Delors. Well, I think personally that Delors was one of the good presidents of the commission. There were three really great presidents. One was Hallstein himself, who managed to make the commission, perhaps exaggeratedly, an equal to the Council of Ministers. Very important that the commission should not be a secretariat or a subordinate doing the will of the nation states. It's got to be something that sees further, is higher in its vision, and stands for everybody's interests and not just the national states. And Hallstein was very fully aware of that, and I remember, you know, I worked very closely with him too, and he was very good at doing that. He was an extraordinary man. Everybody thought he was dull, but he wasn't. He was a bachelor, he was a lawyer, a law professor, he'd driven around in a grey Mercedes, but when you opened the door of the Mercedes, the leather was scarlet. So there was a sort of other side to Hallstein, a side of great humour as well, which I have to say, which modified the normal picture of Hallstein as a grey German bureaucrat. He wasn't that at all. He was the first great president. I think the second, who was very, very good, but in a different way, was our own Roy Jenkins. Because Roy, I remember when there was talk about Roy becoming president, I was saying, well, George Thompson would be very good. And Molly said, no, Roy is a political animal. And I said to Bill Rogers on one occasion, do you think Roy would be a good president? And Bill said, I think Roy has seen a paperclip. And that rather summed up the way that Roy Jenkins ran the presidency, because he was very much a political figure. He didn't pay too much attention to the detail. He let other people do all that for him. He had his own little coterie who dealt with the nuts and bolts. But he saw the big issues, and it was he who, among others, proposed the euro in his Jean Monnet speech. Florence, that's right. And so to that extent, he pushed the whole thing further. And I think he also did something. He completed the work that Hallstein had done by making certain that the commission sat in on the meetings of the council, even when it was meeting as the council of heads of state and heads of state and government. He made sure that the commission was not subordinate. Now, Delors, I think, did the same sort of thing. I wasn't there when he was president, so I can only speak secondhand. But I think that Delors, even though his rhetoric was sometimes a little bit too provocative, was nevertheless in the same line of making sure that the commission mattered, making sure that the commission was a leader, in the same way as Hallstein and Roy Jenkins. So, you know, I would count Delors as a positive. There are one or two other presidents of the Commission who I would count as negatives. I won't mention their names.
Thank you. Can we take the gentleman here, please?
Thank you. My name is Andy. I'm doing some research on European Union. I think a very great thinker, very great visioner about European Union. Monnet was a very great thinker, very great visioner about to build a European Union. After the Second World War, he was very great. But today, the European Union, the idea. Because today you can see the European Union, many people unemployed, and we don't got enough freedom and democracy, unemployment, not enough human rights, freedom, democracy. Also, we have not enough social equality. That means my question is, he got a very good idea, but today the European Union, it is similar to his idea.
Okay. Thank you. The basic point is that the gentleman accepts that Monet was a great thinker after the Second World War, but today the European Union is something which lacks democracy, freedom, etc., and therefore what is the relevance of Monet to today? Is that basically your point?
Well, I think I would disagree with you if you think that the community now is less democratic than it was in 1950, or for 1952 when it really began. In those days, we had what was called the Common Assembly, not the European Parliament. The Common Assembly was not directly elected by the people. It was appointed by and from the national parliaments. It was therefore less democratic than the European Parliament now is. It had very few powers. It had one enormous power, which was to be able to sack the high authority. It could ditch the high authority on a unanimous vote. And they would all have had to resign. The high authority was then the commission now. It was a power so powerful, so great, it was rather like the boat that Robinson Crusoe built. Remember that story? Robinson Crusoe built a boat to get off his desert island. And it was a wonderful boat. It was great. It would have survived huge seas. But it was so heavy, he couldn't get it down to the water. And that was the boat that Common Assembly, forerunner of the European Parliament, that was the power that it had, but it was the only power virtually. Nowadays, there's quite a different situation. The European Parliament has a say in legislation. It can propose legislation. It can propose all sorts of things that the governments or even the Commission don't like. And the real trouble with the European Parliament is that it's very bad at promoting its own work, at making clear what it does. It sends out very, very boring accounts of its debates, but they always come late. By the time you read them, then you know it's all over. So the European Parliament is never reported accurately, but the European Parliament is a much more powerful body than the Common Assembly was ever in Monet's day. Now, the structures that Monet put in place essentially are a little bit like the structure of the United States of America. That is, you have an executive, that is the commission, but it doesn't have real executive power. It's not like the president. You have a court of justice, which is like the Supreme Court, and you have an assembly, which is rather like the Congress, but you also have the states represented as they originally were in the United States in the Senate. So the picture, the institutional picture that Monet painted is not totally unlike that of the United States of America. I think personally that it needs to be reformed. It needs the constitution that was rejected by the French and the Dutch for really irrelevant reasons. It's a great pity that they rejected them, but their votes were not helpful to them. They weren't helpful to the Europeans either, but they certainly didn't achieve what the people who voted no wanted. The Dutch wanted to pay less, well, that's understandable. The French wanted to have no Turks and no Anglo-Saxon fire and fire liberalism. But their votes on the constitution were totally irrelevant to the issues that they were really in their minds and their stomachs. So the institutional arrangements have not been undermined by the referenda. They are more democratic than people realize. And in fact, I think they even without the new constitution, they're still working quite well. It is, though, very difficult to have 25 countries sitting around the table. It's very difficult to have, I forget how many languages. The amount of simultaneous interpretation that has to go through langue titulaire, that is French or British or English rather, you can't find many translators who are capable of translating from Serbo-Croat or whatever, you know, Bulgarian, say, or Romanian into Swedish, and so on. It's not an easy job. So language is the problem, numbers is the problem, particular interests, particular history is the problem. All these problems are harder to fit into the Monet-type institutional framework, but what we need is to have a better version of what Monet proposed, not something looser, which is what we'll get if we don't do something about it. Hence my concern to have a new constitution.
Okay, we have several questions. Would you mind if we group
them? Take them together,
questions?
Yeah, why not? If I can hear them.
Oh, sorry, there's a microphone here. I'm sorry, I should have.
Karen Smith from the International Relations Department here at the London School of Economics. How much of a blow did it feel like in 1954 when the French rejected the European Defense Community? And was there optimism that Europe has to continue and will continue even after that blow? And then compared to today, I mean, you were quite pessimistic there at the end in describing the reactions to the French and Dutch rejections of the Constitution. Do you think today there is still this feeling that Europe has to continue and will continue?
Thank you.
Can I answer that now?
Yes,
because
yes.
I think it's probably rather different from the other question. First of all, I was when EDC was defeated on a procedural vote in the European Parliament and in the French Assembly in 1954, I was in Rome reporting for the New Statesman. And the defeat of EDC coincided with the death of Alcide De Gasperi. And it was a moment of absolute horror for many Europeans in Rome. But there was still the sense that Europe had to continue. I remember talking to people in Luxembourg, in the coal and steel community, about it, and they said, it's very, very difficult. There were white faces. You know, it was a real blow, much bigger blow than the blow of the constitutional referenda. But people were still, at that time, under the... They could still remember the war. They could still see the impetus that had led to the building of the European Union. They haven't got that now. But what they do have is the process which has begun, the process of integration, the process of economic integration, the expectation that somehow the European Union will be able to solve the great problems of unemployment and slow growth, which at the moment is finding very difficult to deal with, but nevertheless, it creates the conditions for. One of the problems, I think I said to our chairman before we started this, is that the contribution that Europe can make to things like unemployment and growth are indirect. The contribution is to create the conditions whereby governments and firms and individuals can improve their lot, can open the market so that they can sell abroad, can open the market so that they aren't subject to unfair competition, and so on. It's an opportunity, but it's not a solution. Europe is a chance, but it's not the answer. And that makes people very unhappy because they want answers. They want to create jobs now. Well, you can't do that, but Europe can provide the framework or the basis or the contexts in which that can be done. So, and that is happening. It's happened already with the opening of the single market. And we just have to hang on to that and hope that the impetus of what we've created is as strong as the impetus of what we inherited in the war that made us go on after 1954. I think that really is the answer to your question.
Thank you. Can we take the gentleman over here, please?
Thank you. John Stevens, I was just wondering what you feel would be Monet's attitude towards an inner core built around the Eurozone.
I think the orthodox answer to that is he would be against it. He would try to get everybody in. But I think also that he believed, even when he built the European Union in 1950, it was an inner core then. It was six. And he wanted the British in. And the only way to get them in was to go ahead and make it work. He didn't believe that the British would join on an idea or a word, but only on a fact. And the fact of Europe existing would make the British finally join. And I suspect that even though the orthodox answer to your question is we don't want inner cores, we want everybody to go ahead together, I don't think Monet would be totally against the idea of closer unity by certain countries in, for example, defense arrangements or security arrangements, provided the door was left open to the other countries that didn't immediately join. I don't think he would like a two-speed Europe, but I think he would like a Europe which had a core to which you could aggregate the other members when they felt that it was appropriate for them. So, it's a slightly nuanced answer, I'm afraid, but that, I think, is what Monet would probably say. He wouldn't use words like nuanced. He would say, if people want to go ahead, why not?
I think we... Okay, there's several hands. Do you mind if we try to take
it?
Just a few questions. The gentleman here first at the back, thank you. Yeah, you. There's a microphone just behind you.
Don't think I need microscope, microphone. Nevertheless, the Jean Monnet's Europe was put together in challenge to USA. And that the tomorrow's Europe may not necessarily be the Jean Monnet's Europe. Tomorrow's Europe will be one which will evolve in response to challenges that will come tomorrow. Now, talking of the tomorrow's challenge, China's emergence, what kind of impact it might have on the evolution of Europe? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is the impact of China?
Could we take the gentleman just next to him, please?
I'm just a member of the public. I'll make my question very short. I mean, you've talked a lot about Monet, obviously, because that's the subject of the discussion, but just ask, you seem quite pessimistic about the future of in Europe. Yeah, am I right in that or not?
Okay. And I think we have...
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
You seem pessimistic about the future of Europe. And you have your answer already. And I think we have a question here. Was that? Yes. Just in the middle, this is the last question here. Can you raise your hand?
Thank you. Ben Jones, European Movement member. From the clip we saw earlier on, there was obviously a lot of scepticism, even in the founding member states post-war. Where did Jean Monnet have his power base? Who were his backers in order to develop this project? In particular, I'm thinking, did he have powerful friends in Washington who could publicize his arguments with leaders in Europe?
Thank you.
Okay. Right. Well, first of all, on China, Monet, of course, had a very close connection with China. He worked in China on the Hong Kong-Shanghai railways, and he raised money for the Chinese railways over a long period, long before he was associated with the idea of Europe. He got on very well with Chiang Kai-shek and with his wife, and he had great difficulty at first in understanding the Chinese until he spoke to an old China hand who said, don't try to understand, you never will. But what you have to do is make your words and your actions coincide always be consistent, always be polite, and always be patient, because it's rude to accept on the first instance. You have to go on trying, go on trying. And therefore, I think Monet would, if Monet were alive today, he'd be a very good ambassador in China. But the China is one of the major world, I can't say a problem, it's a major world subject which Europe should be addressing and is to some extent addressing quite well. The Chinese have always been very attentive to what's happening in Europe, partly because they're interested in the structure and partly because I think at one time they were keen to see another power arising which would be on a level with the Soviet Union, as it then was, and the Americans, as they still are. And therefore, the problem with China, if there is a problem, is now low-wage competition. I don't know if you get things in the post, as I so often do, offering me shoes which are going to weigh about an ounce, and they're made, they're wonderfully cheap, but they're made by, presumably, sweatshops. And one of the great difficulties in globalization is how Europe is to respond to very, very low-wage competition from places like China, India, and also other parts of the Far East, and even in Latin America. So China is certainly one of the issues that Monet would be addressing if he were still there to help us. Second question, am I pessimistic? No, I'm not. The Monet always said, I'm never pessimistic. And it's perfectly true that he wasn't pessimistic. I remember even on one occasion he said, if I were in the condemned cell, this is the meal I would have. And it was French haricot vert, which he loved. But he was never pessimistic. He was always trying to find ways out of the current difficulty. And I have to tell you that over the lifetime that I've spent working in and around and with the European Union, there has always been a crisis. Never. There's never been anything but a crisis. C.V. d'Avignon, who was a member of the Commission, I think vice president of the Commission at one time, the banker, the Belgian banker, used to have a cartoon on the wall of his office from the New Yorker. And I think the caption was somebody on the telephone saying, it's Europe, they're in disarray again. Well, Europe was always in disarray. There was always a great sort of cliffhanger going on. Would the coal and steel community survive the defeat of EDC that we heard about? Would the common market treaty be signed? Would Euratom work? Would the treaty be ratified? Would the British join? Would the free trade area idea work? Would EFTA work? Would the French come in after the empty chair policy? Would the British come in and wreck the community? And, you know, every day, every week, there is a crisis. It makes Tony Blair's life look easy. And frankly, one can't be pessimistic. One just has to be determined. And that's what mattered. And that's what Monet was, really. He was sometimes gloomy. He was sometimes saddened by what happened, as he said. C'était tristant, when the British were vetoed. But the thing to do was get on with the job. That's what he was always about. And insofar as I can have the same spirit, which I hope I have, I would say let's face the difficulties, like the dogs with eyes as big as saucers. Feel the fear, look at it, face it, go on. That's Monet's attitude, really, I think all the time. So I'm not pessimistic any more than he was. Any less than he was, maybe not. Now, what was the third question?
Who were the backers of Monet?
What was Monet's power base? Well, the answer is a very difficult to give, because in a sense he had friends in high places, in America particularly, because he worked in America. He had influence in France, because he had René Pleven, who was later Prime Minister, had been one of his assistants at one time. He had very good helpers. This sounds pompous of me to say this. He was very good at choosing his assistants. One of them was Pierre Ury, who was the most brilliant economist I've ever met. Another was Secord, Cam Secord. Another was Trouin, the Franco, no, Canadian-Belgian economist. Another was, well, there were a whole raft of people that Monet managed to gather around him who made his intellectual caliber even greater than it would have been without them. He was very good at that. He had a good power base of his own. He had the chance of knowing people like McCloy, whom we saw on screen, and working also with Roosevelt, although Roosevelt was rather a mystery to Monet. I remember when François de Fontaine was writing Monet's memoirs, or ghosting Monet's memoirs, he was trying to persuade Monet to say what was Roosevelt like to work with. And all that Monet could say was, il voulait gagner la guerre. Il voulait gagner la guerre. And poor old François couldn't get more out of him than that. So the passages in Monet's memoirs about Roosevelt are rather meager. But he had, to some extent, he had those contacts. But why had he got the contacts? Why had he managed to impress Chiang Kai-shek? He hadn't any money to offer him. What he had was this ability to find solutions to problems that were breaking the heads of other people. Qui cassait la tête aux autres. And Monet's great strength was that he didn't want to be anybody. He wanted to do things. And therefore, he was always willing to provide somebody who was in a real difficulty with a solution and let them take the credit for it. Because he always said, I'm not a politician, but politicians have to take risks. They take the risks. They let them have the credit. And he had the ideas. He used to say, it's very easy to have ideas. I think it is, actually. It's not difficult to dream up schemes. People write in the papers all the time, solving problems which governments can't solve. Read the correspondence column of the Times and the Independent. But ideas are easy. What is hard is to think them through and then to put them to the people who may accept them. And Monet was very persuasive. He had an aunt called, a great aunt called Marie La, she had her nickname in the family was Marie La Rabâcheuse, because she went on and on and on, talked the hind leg of a donkey. Monet could talk the hind leg of a donkey. And he did manage to get his ideas across. So I think the power base that he had really was, it was himself, it was his own character. And although in the clip you saw he was an old man, and he wasn't any longer the kind of dynamic figure he'd been when he was, for example, Deputy Secretary General of the League of Nations. In those days, even then, he was unorthodox. Louise Weiss, who wrote a very good book about her experiences with Monet, said that people used to produce dossiers with complicated solutions to problems and so on, and he would never read them. It'd pile up on his desk, and he'd call in the man who'd written the dossier, and then he would ask that man key questions that went to the jugular. And he was terribly good at that, and the man would have to spill the beans, say what was really the key thing to do. And Monet was very good at seeing what was the key thing that you must do in order to advance whatever the project was. And as I say, the project was not Europe. The project was solving problems in the world. And that really is where I sometimes feel that we need statesmen who will pull back a bit from the immediate problems of Europe and look at what Europe has got on its agenda. And it's amazing how much we have to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. We ask our speakers to sing for their supper. You've sung very, very well. Now it's time for supper. Let me, on your behalf, thank our speaker, Richard Main, very much indeed. I've enjoyed that tremendously. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.